compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. You notice the taco crunch that Cyrus likes to do? He actually has a taco right up to the microphone. Cyrus taking it. There we go. Eaten during the work shift. It is Taco Tuesday, and I don't know what that means other than that we like tacos here. And I like you. I'd like to talk to you. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Just want to mention before we get too far into the program that, of course, this being Holy Week, some really momentous things are coming up at the end of the week leading up to Easter. The Triduum, which is a Latin word that means 3 days. And it might be that you're not able to get to your parish for the Triduum, but you can join us here at Relevant Radio. So from 11 a.m. or 6 p.m. Central, every day, Central Time, you can hear Father Rocky's Holy Week mission entitled Close to Jesus to the Last, The Passion of Christ in Five Parts. On Holy Thursday, Father Rocky will celebrate Mass at 5 p.m. Central. And then on Good Friday, you can join him for a Good Friday service at 4 p.m. Central. Relevant Radio will also carry the Easter Vigil Mass from the Vatican starting at 1:30 p.m. Central Time on Holy Saturday. And all of this, all the schedule of events and everything is available at relevantradio.com or on the Relevant Radio app. Full service, 888-914-9149. Let's start off in Central Valley, California and talk to John. Hi, John. Welcome.
Thank you. Question is there any reparative value in being able to receive communion but not in reparations for those who may be unworthily receiving?
So in other words, you're at Mass, you can receive Holy Communion, but you refrain from doing so as some kind of reparation for people who can't receive Holy Communion?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think so, no. Because the act of abstaining from receiving Holy Communion is not in itself a meritorious act. I mean, unless there's some extenuating circumstance. You know, like let's say that you've broken the fast of 1 hour before communion, so you refrain from receiving. Well, that's meritorious because you're being faithful in the small detail of observing the church's required fast. But if you're just doing it, in other words, if you're going without, I don't see how that is going to benefit anyone. Rather, if you receive Holy Communion, offer that for the sake of those who can't receive Holy Communion. I'm wondering if you're thinking about fasting in solidarity with those who are hungry. So people who are hungry and can't eat, and so you fast from a meal in solidarity with them. That might be what you're thinking of, but there's no one-to-one comparison that I can see with receiving Holy Communion. It's better to receive it and then offer those graces for those people.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, John. Let's see. Let's go to Pat now in Fredonia, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. I spent some time with some friends that none of them are Catholic. I make it very clear that I am Catholic, but being so, they often throw questions at me, and I have to be honest, I don't know my Bible or the answers as well as I wish I did. Mm-hmm. The one
that's why I'm here, by the way.
Last is,
that's what I'm here for, is to help you get there.
Okay. The last one is, when God created Earth and Adam and Eve, how did that go down through the years that we know that, other than reading it in the Bible?
Well,
was it written down someplace or?
Mm-hmm. Well, Moses wrote down at least the cursory description of that in the book of Genesis. The first five books of the Bible were written initially, at least by Moses. So that took place long, long after the events. But the Lord inspired him with this knowledge, and he received it not only by way of divine revelation, but he also knew the story as had been handed down from ancient times. So that's one way. But there's another way, and that is that throughout the whole wide world, in all places, civilizations, tribes, people in general, who have had no contact with one another, it turns out, from time immemorial, they have all known about the flood. And in their own way, sometimes in a more confused way, sometimes in a more accurate way, they not only know of the flood, but they have their own stories of the flood that are in some cases strikingly similar to that of the flood story told in the book of Genesis. There's also something known as the Gilgamesh myth. And I don't say myth in the sense that it's not true, but sort of the mythological story that has been handed down in the Near East. And it tracks with the flood story. And I'll give you one specific example that I find very interesting, and that is when the French Jesuit missionaries went to what is now northern New York State in southern Canada, so southern Ontario, and they were evangelizing this confederation of different indigenous tribes. We know this confederation as the Iroquois, but it was, you know, a variety of different tribes that they went to, and you know, any number of these priests suffered martyrdom for their efforts. But in any case, when they got there and they learned their language and they began to converse with them, they were astonished to find that these people who had, for the most part, never had any contact whatsoever with any Westerner, they already knew the flood story and they knew about Adam and Eve. Now, they had their own spin on it, so there were details that were different, but they knew all about this great flood. And they knew all about our first parents, Adam and Eve. So when the missionaries got there and were going to start telling them about that, they realized they already know. And the reason is because these events were real, and human history and our collective memory, wherever you may live, received these stories in these myths, in these tales. So it's quite an amazing thing when you consider it just anthropologically, outside of the Bible itself. There's vast amounts of evidence anthropologically that these events were real. So that's another great reservoir of knowledge that we have about the flood, etc. Does that help, Pat?
Okay, that's very, very interesting. And so basically, like when God flooded the world and Noah took a lot of this knowledge or these stories with him that then pass on to his family down the road.
Right. Yes. So eight people in all were saved in the ark. And it was from those eight people that what had come before, so the Adam and Eve story and everything that had come before, was passed down again from Noah and his family and then proliferated.
And the part that you mentioned about when the missionaries came over to this part of the land, that was that like the Holy Spirit coming down to these people and telling them that they already knew?
No, I don't think so. Because these people were hostile to Christianity. So they were not, I mean, these tribes that I'm talking about here. So the Algonquin, the Mohawks, the various tribes. The point is that I would not attribute that to the Holy Spirit enlightening them as much as I would attribute it to this historical fact was known from the time it happened, and it was passed down continuously so that as people migrated to different parts of the earth, they took these stories with them and told them in their own way. And you know how it is. You probably played the game of telephone when you were a kid in school. And 30 kids in the classroom, you start with the first kid who whispers some sentence in the ear of the person next to him, and then it goes all the way to the kid at the other end. And by the time he comes out, it's usually something funny and different, and you see how things corrupt along the way. But this story was so powerful and so vivid that the major outlines of the story, not to mention Adam and Eve, they remained.
Okay, very good.
It's quite something. Yeah, thank you, Pat. Let's go to Joe now in Las Vegas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Patrick. My question is, I'm a little confused as to the practice of excommunication. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I'll encounter somebody who either mentions that they have been in the past or they know somebody. And I'm under the impression or belief that through a good act of sacramental confession, you know, all sins can be forgiven. And so if you give me a, you know, brief history, recent history, and I could listen off the air for clarification, I'd appreciate it.
You got it, Joe. And you're welcome to stay on the line if you want to. It's up to you. Well, excommunication is a penalty that is applied in the case of a sin, or in the canon lawyers would refer to a delict. That's a technical term. It refers to a canonical crime. And there are a lot of technical aspects to this that I don't think that I should try to go into, only because that's really the province of canon lawyers. And so for something more magisterial and more precise, I would refer to canon law commentators. But for this, we can just say the following, that when somebody commits certain sins that are also canonical crimes, the penalty for that crime is the punishment of excommunication. And excommunication, first of all, does not mean, as many people I think assume, it does not mean that the church is damning anyone to hell. It does not mean that the church is saying, you go to hell. It means nothing of the sort. It's a medicinal attempt to get the person's attention, to say, you have been cut off from the life of the sacraments and from participating in the day-to-day regular life of the church, which is the last remedy available to the church. And the hope is that when somebody is excommunicated, whether that's declared on the part of the church or it's something that happens, the phrase is late sententiae, which means, roughly speaking in English, that it's by the very act itself that the person excommunicates himself by doing this. So the state of excommunication is incurred by the very act of committing that sin. That happens in some instances. So if a priest were to intentionally reveal the contents of somebody's confession, that would automatically incur excommunication. It wouldn't be necessary for the church to proclaim it. It would have already happened. And the same would be true in the case of a procured abortion. So if a woman were to procure an abortion, she's automatically, by that fact, excommunicated. Now, to your point, we have to make a distinction here, Joe, between the sin and the penalty that's due to sin. So the excommunication is a penalty that's applied. It's not the sin itself. So yes, a woman who has committed an abortion, to use that as a common example, if she repents in her heart, Lord, I'm sorry I did this, please forgive me, she's forgiven. Now, it remains for this canonical penalty to be officially lifted, which is easily done in the confessional. So in modern times, the way this happens is virtually all priests, if not all priests, have this faculty granted to them, such that when they're hearing a confession and a woman confesses the sin of abortion, the priest can and does, in that very act of hearing her confession and absolving her of her sins, he also has the power to lift the excommunication. So it's no longer present. And one in the same confession accomplishes both actions. So that's important to remember. Now, there are other, obviously, many other different ways in which somebody could incur excommunication, although you don't really hear much about that. The last thing that I'll say is that historically, it was far more common for this penalty to be applied than it is now. It seems like now bishops are very reluctant to apply this penalty. I'm not entirely sure why, but it seems to be that way. So for something more specific or more scholarly, I would refer you to a canon law blog by Dr. Ed Peters. And you just have to look up his name. I forget now whether it's In Light of the Law or it's Canon Law Blog. It's one of the two. He had one and then he changed to the other. But he's a professor of canon law at Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit. And he's a true expert on this topic. So if you want to read up further, I would suggest you go in that direction. I hope that's helpful to you, Joe. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it is. So basically, well, I use that term, and there I use it. So a person going to a confession should also mention if they had been in the past, whether rightly or incorrectly, excommunicated. By bringing that up would be very important for the confessor to know.
Sure. So let's assume, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, are we saying that this is not in the context of an abortion, right? There's something else happened?
Well, no, I don't know what anybody who's mentioned that to me, and it's been a few, they have never mentioned, and I said, well, no, I don't care to know that. That's between you and God and the confessor. but I'd say bring it up to the in confessional, and it in a good confession, all things like in divine mercy, you know, there's no sin that God would not, you know.
Sure, I understand that point, Joe, and I agree with you. But let's keep in mind, though, this is not, there are two different issues here, the sin and the penalty. So it is true that all sins can be forgiven, but you may have committed a canonical crime that incurs excommunication that the priest cannot lift in the confessional. So if you go to confession and say, bless me, Father, for I have sinned, it's been 5 years since my last confession, these are my sins, and oh, by the way, I committed this canonical crime and the church excommunicated me, he may very well not be able to lift that. It might be something that's reserved to the Holy See, or it might be something that the bishop would have to lift. So it's not exactly true that in every situation, if someone had been excommunicated, that it can be lifted in the confessional. It certainly is true in the case of a woman who has had an abortion and goes to confession. You see
that's,
what I mean?
That's
you see
what
the
I'm
difference?
Confused about is how, if that, say a person had been, mm-hmm. and I had told them that if they go to confession and mentioned that, well, I don't understand why a particular confessor could not do that.
The reason is because he may not have the authority granted to him. Some excommunications are only able to be lifted by the Holy See, by the Pope. Some excommunications can be lifted by the bishop. And some excommunications, and most notably that of what occurs with abortion, can be lifted by a parish priest in confession. But that's the key to remember. Just because you go to confession doesn't mean that the excommunication has thereby been lifted. It depends on what it's for.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense now?
Oh, all right. Yeah, so I'll look into that book you mentioned and draw some more insight on that before I try to give advice and find out later it was incorrect.
Yeah, I've learned the hard way. The best thing to do is to seek out the experts. So that's why I think Dr. Ed Peters' website, it's a blog actually, I think that's going to be very helpful to you. I follow it closely, I read it, and I find it very helpful in my own knowledge on this topic. So, okay, Joe, well, thank you. And you know what, Cyrus, at the break, why don't we get that link to his blog posted for those who want to read it? We'll do that. Why don't we take a break now, and then we'll come back with more of your phone calls on the Patrick Madrid Show. The number to dial to be on the air is 888-914-9149. I'm taking all comers, so hit me with your best shot, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Love this music. Totally gets me into the mood for tacos. What can I say? 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you were not a big taco guy before you started working on this program, were you?
False.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on.
All right. Who doesn't like tacos?
Thanks, Patrick Madrid, for introducing me to tacos.
I didn't introduce you to tacos, but I brought you to a whole new level.
I'll tell you one thing. John Harper from Morning Air has never had a taco.
That's not right.
It's not. It actually makes me a little sad.
That's not right.
I'm sad for him. Yeah.
Was he raised by wolves? I mean, because I know wolves don't eat tacos.
I don't know. You'll have to ask him. He's never had a taco. He's never seen Star Wars, and he's never used an ATM. But the taco one's really that's the big one. I mean,
that
I'm like
hurts.
Really sad.
I need to grab him and we need to go get tacos. And You can tag along if you want.
I would love to tag along. I'll take pictures. I want to that needs to be documented.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. All right, 888-914-9149. That's the number to dial. Let's go now to New York and talk to Zulma. Hi, Zulma.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, I have a question. I'm a new listener and a new caller.
Well, welcome.
And my question is, thanks. I'm a Catholic. My family is a Catholic. In fact, my grandmother was a practicing Catholic. Mm-hmm. But I was married in the evangelical church because the Catholic church wouldn't marry me.
Okay.
Because my
husband
was divorced.
Did they say why not?
Because my husband was divorced and he didn't have an annulment. Mm-hmm. And so we married in the evangelical church, but I always attended my Catholic church. My daughters were in the Catholic schools from pre-K 3 to through college. My little one went to a Jesuit school at Fordham University. The other one went to also parochial college. Mm-hmm. And so we always stayed in the Catholic church, and I've always received communion, but I always felt like it wasn't right, but I just
couldn't go to church and not do it. Mm-hmm. So my question is, am I supposed to, is it wrong or right for me to receive communion?
Okay. Well, let's start here, Zulma. First of all, I want you to know that no matter what has happened and how much time has gone by, Jesus loves you and he wants you to be happy, and you can always come back to the full practice of your faith in the Catholic Church. The door is open. We've left the light on for you, and we're going to welcome you with open arms. Okay, so just know that.
Well, I've never left it. That's the thing, Patrick. I've never left it. I just, ever since I started listening to Relevant Radio, I've always heard that receiving communion, if you're married in another religion, I'm not sure that that's doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. It's not doing the right thing. So let's dig into that point right there. Jesus said, as you know, every time the question came up in the Gospels about divorce and remarriage, each time Jesus says, if a man divorces his wife and remarries, he commits adultery. Now, in Matthew 19, there's the proviso. He says, if a man divorces his wife, except in the case of porneia, that Greek word there means sexual unlawfulness. So he says, if a man divorces his wife, except in the case of porneia, and marries another, he commits adultery. But in all the other instances, Jesus simply says, if a man divorces his wife and remarries, he commits adultery. Now, this is true, of course, for women who get divorced and remarry. So the issue here is that the man that you married, it's assumed by the church, unless it can determine otherwise, and that's what the process that we commonly call an annulment. The church can't annul a valid marriage, but the church can investigate to find out if maybe that marriage was not valid from the beginning, in which case the church can declare that it's null, in which case then you would be free to marry him. But until it's determined whether or not his first marriage was valid, the church assumes that it was valid, which means that he's still a married man, which means that he's not free to marry you. Now, I realize that these things happened long ago, but that's the essence of the problem. So even though you've never left the Catholic Church, in a sense, you've been apart from the sacraments because all those Holy Communions that you received were received and actually... I mean, I don't mean to be unnecessarily blunt, but I feel the need to say this, that those were sacrilegious communions because you were living objectively in the state of adultery. So as a Catholic, you have the right to receive the sacraments, but you also have the obligation to receive the sacraments in the state of grace. So you can't just say, well, I know that I shouldn't be in this situation, but I'm going to continue going to Holy Communion. So the Lord knows your heart. I'm not here to judge anything. The Lord knows your heart. But I can say, objectively speaking, that even though you were going to Mass or receiving the sacraments, it was not having the spiritual effect. And this is probably why you had that feeling deep down inside that something wasn't right. So there is a way to resolve this problem. And that would be, and I know this is easier said than done, but it can be done, and couples do this. And that would be to live with your husband as brother and wife while that annulment process is initiated. And the two of you, you don't live as married people do. I mean, you can live under the same roof, but you know what I'm saying. And then make a good confession. And the good confession would go something like this, Zulma. You'd say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been X number of years since my last good confession," meaning since the last time you went to confession and you told all of your serious sins and any other sins you might have, but all of the serious sins, and you were truly sorry for those, and you knew that you had been forgiven. So tell him that, and then say, "In the years since then, I have been living with the man. We were civilly married. It was a divorce and remarried situation. And I've got that sin I need to confess. And I also have got the sins of going to Holy Communion." And you may say, "I don't remember how many times I went." Or you may say, "I went every Sunday for 20 years. Or, you know, you'll have to give a sense of how many times it happened. And whatever other mortal sins may be on your soul from that last good confession till the present. And then have a firm purpose of amendment, meaning that you intend not to fall into sin again. Only God knows the future, and he knows that we're weak, and we know that we're weak. But the intention is that you're going to strive to avoid to fall into any sins in the future. And then you are sincerely sorry for your sins. You make your act of contrition. He will absolve you. And not only will all of those sins be wiped away, but you are now free to go receive Holy Communion, and it will become spiritually fruitful for you. It'll become, you know, that joyful union with the Lord that you've been seeking all these years, and you'll finally be able to do that. So you're one good confession away from sanctity. And I'm not going to suggest that it will necessarily be an easy road, but it's not an impossible road. And because you really want Jesus, if you follow that road, you're going to have all those problems cleared up. You know you'll be forgiven. You know that you can receive Holy Communion. And assuming that there's a grounds for a declaration of nullity with your husband's first marriage, once that process is completed, if the church determines, yes, that there's grounds for this, then you and he can resume a typical married life. And they lived happily ever after, kind of thing.
Can I make another point, Patrick?
Sure.
My husband and I, we've been separated for 11 years, so that annulment is never going to take place.
Okay. Well, that's a dimension of the story that's even better. So now you no longer have to worry about that. And there's no question about living as brother and sister. You can go today, Zulma, and go to confession. And you bring up the things that I just talked about, including all your sins. In other words, don't hold anything back. Don't say, "Well, I'm just embarrassed by this one sin. I'll tell everything else, but not this one sin." Give everything to the priest. Number and kind. What kind of sin was it, and how many times do you think it happened? Yeah. And be truly sorry. And you know what? A huge weight is going to lift off your shoulders. And you could receive Holy Communion today. You go to confession, you could receive Holy Communion today and every day after for the rest of your life.
Thank Isn't you so beautiful? Much, Patrick.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes, yes.
You will be walking on air, my friend. You will be so happy. And people are going to say, "Zulma, what happened?" And you're going to say, "The Lord saved me.
I have gotten grace. That's what happened."
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay, thank you so much, Patrick. Happy
You're
Easter.
Welcome. Thank you. Happy Easter to you. What a resurrection moment, right? 888-914-9149. Let's go to Teresa now in Huntington Beach, California. Hi, Teresa. I took a girl to the prom at Huntington Beach High School once. That's my only connection to that school. I don't remember her name, and I'm sure she doesn't remember my name.
It's all good. I am curious if you can elaborate on, with science and with IVF, on how that's a mortal sin.
IVF being in vitro fertilization?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's a mortal sin for fundamentally two reasons. Number one is that it reduces the marital act. And I think you know what I mean by that, right?
Mm-hmm.
The marital act? Okay. So it reduces, we have kids who listen to the program. So it reduces the marital act to a laboratory experiment, and literally a laboratory experiment, because in vitro is the Latin phrase for in glass. So it's literally in a tube or a petri dish of some sort. It's a glass container. And this is contrary to God's plan for married love. God's plan for married love is the intimacy of the two spouses in a way that does not foreclose on the possibility of the transmission of life. So the first reason why this is sinful is that it involves this removal of married intimacy, and now in the context of a laboratory experiment. A subset to that is the sin on the part of the man, who has to contribute. And Teresa, as I say, this is a family show, so I have to be circumspect, but I think you know what I mean here. The man has to contribute to this process, right? And the way in which that's done is immoral. In itself, it's immoral. So it requires the man to engage in an immoral activity. And so that's another serious problem right there. And then the third problem is that the vast majority of in vitro fertilization procedures involve the fertilization of more than one ovum. Typically, it's going to be maybe as many as a half a dozen. And almost always, the couple determines which one they want to keep. So they might be told, well, we've got three females and two males. And so the vast majority of cases involve the destruction, the wanton killing of those embryos who are human beings who are not chosen, and they're destroyed. Sometimes they're put on ice indefinitely, and that's a horror story unto itself. That's another sin that is incurred because it is a deeply, deeply sinful attack on the human dignity of those unborn children. But even more so would be their wanton destruction if they're not chosen for implantation. So those three major areas all converge in IVF to make it a seriously sinful process. Now, there are other, you know, there are other matters that are sort of subsets to those things, but those three things are the hydra-headed monster reason why IVF is so sinful. Now, one thing I need to add, Teresa, the church's teaching does not in any sense extend to any child who is conceived that way. So the church does not in any way look down upon or judge or in any way have a negative approach to the children who are conceived this way. They are the children of God, and they are just like you and I and everyone else. They have the right to life, and so the church loves them and accepts them just as it would any other child, regardless of how the child is conceived. Rather, the condemnation is of the act itself that led to that conception. We have to make that part clear so that people don't mistakenly think that there's any stigma associated with the children who were born by IVF. There is no such stigma. Does that make sense?
It does. Is IVF then the only part of the fertility that's the mortal sin? Meaning there's other parts of fertility that are assisted?
Infertility treatment? Infertility treatment?
Yes.
No, there are other forms of infertility treatment that would also be seriously immoral. So surrogacy, for example. So it's not the same as IVF because it's not taking place in glass. But if a husband and a wife contribute the genetic material for a conception, and then that conception, well, I guess it would be in this case, it would be IVF initially, but then the embryo would be transferred to the uterus of a surrogate, that is also seriously sinful. to introduce a third party into the marriage in whatever sense. I mean, that's just one way in which it could happen, but the church regards that as a serious distortion and violation of married love and procreation. Now, there are other scenarios, I suppose, but that's another one that's fairly common nowadays.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I hope that's helpful. Lots of food for thought there, right? Well, let's take a break, and we will think about those things and come back to your phone calls. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. I have lines open right now, so call in, 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
For more of the Patrick Madrid Show, visit relevantradio.com/Patrick.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, a little jaunty Taco Tuesday music for you today. Welcome back. The number is 888-914-9149. We're going to go now to Woodstock, Georgia, and talk to Rayanne. Hi, Rayanne. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. First of all, God bless you. Thank you for the way that you're so loving and gentle, helping us understand our beautiful faith.
Thank you.
I'm a new Catholic. I came into the church 3 years ago at the vigil, and I'm so happy to be home.
Mm-hmm.
I would like
welcome
to
home.
Know. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I feel very, this is where I need to be.
Beautiful.
How is it that I can console the heart of Jesus? Are there acts and or prayers that I can specifically do for that?
There are. So, for example, St. Margaret Mary Alacoque, she received from Jesus in the Sacred Heart revelations to her the request for the five first Saturdays that are
Fridays.
Saturdays.
No?
Saturdays, yeah.
Okay, so the, sorry.
No, it's okay. I just was kind of stumbling over my own. there are two things. One is the one from Fatima, and then the other one is the one from the Sacred Heart Revelations. And I want to double check that. So we've got the devotion of the five first, maybe it is Fridays, but it is a way of consoling the heart of Jesus by going to Mass and communion and go to confession, the five first Fridays of the year, and or any first Fridays, and you offer prayers of reparation for blasphemy and other sins against the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And that's that symbol of the Sacred Heart is the visual symbol of how much the Lord loves us and how much He wants to forgive us of our sins. So this is also true for the five first Saturdays that were granted to the children at Fatima. And it involves you go to confession in Mass and receive Holy Communion, and you pray the rosary. And in the case of the five first Saturdays, it involves in your prayers of the rosary, you meditate on the mysteries and you offer your prayers as a reparation for these sins that are committed against the Lord. Now, the ones that came through St. Margaret Mary Alacoque are the same idea, but they are something that's specifically aimed at consoling the heart of Jesus. So those five first Fridays, same thing is in place. So it's the five first Fridays. I shouldn't say the five first. It's the first Friday. So you could have any combination. You could start in any month, and then you just go each of the first Fridays for the consecutive 4 months after that. And those are intended to be specifically focused on consoling the heart of Jesus. The first Saturdays are very Marian in their focus. I mean, ultimately, it's focusing on God himself. But here's some mm-hmm. of the here's some of the promises that are made to those who console the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And one good way to do this is to enthrone an image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus in your home. And traditionally, it's done with a side-by-side picture of Our Lady and her Immaculate Heart. So here's some of the promises that are granted. So number one, Jesus says, I will give them all the necessary graces in their state of life. I will establish peace in their homes. I will comfort them in all their afflictions. I will be a secure refuge during life and above all in death. I will bestow abundant blessings upon all their undertakings. Sinners will find in my heart the source of an infinite ocean of mercy. Lukewarm souls will become fervent. Fervent souls shall quickly mount to high perfection. I will bless every place in which an image of my heart is exposed and honored. I will give to priests the gift of touching the most hardened hearts. Those who shall promote this devotion shall have their names written in my heart. And then the last one is, I promise you in the excessive mercy of my heart that my all-powerful love will grant to all those who receive Holy Communion on the first Fridays in 9 consecutive months the grace of final perseverance. They shall not die in my disgrace, nor without receiving their sacraments. My divine heart shall be their safe refuge in their last moment. So again, to make a distinction, because I believe I misspoke. So this is the 9 first Fridays. And then for the Fatima one, it's the 5 first Saturdays. But it's the same idea, the same goal, and the same results. So that would be a really good and time-honored way of at least starting what you want to do. Does that make sense?
Oh, it's so beautiful. Yes. Thank you. Now, your explanation has brought to mind another question. Mm-hmm. Do I have time?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to consecrate myself to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, but part of the consecration includes a promise to attend Mass every day and pray the Rosary every day, and so that's what has stopped me. I'm afraid there will be times, like when I go to work, I don't get to attend Mass every day. So can I still, make this enthronement in my home even though I'm not consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary?
You can. And there's some wonderful things that you can do. First of all, you can be enrolled in the Brown Scapular of Our Lady Mount Carmel. And that's an official act of consecration. There's also the 33 Days to Morning Glory devotion. There's a book by that same title in which you can, for 33 days, intellectually and spiritually prepare. And then on the final day, you make your consecration to Our Lady. So that's a book you can get and begin doing right away if you wanted to do so. And keeping in mind that God doesn't expect the impossible from you, He knows that if it's impossible for you to get to Mass because of work or an illness or some other reason, that you can't. So it's not held against you. It's not as though you have failed somehow. You strive to do the best you can. And I'll give you an example, going back to Fatima. Our Lady appeared to the children in Fatima in 1917 from the span of time from May 13th through October the 13th. Now, because of the interference of the local government, and also I think the very first time it happened, it might have been that Lucia's mother was really opposing her story that she was seeing these apparitions. But at least 1 month and possibly 2 months, the children were prevented from going after Our Lady had told them every month on this day, come here to this holmoak, to this place in the field where the tree was, where she would appear above the tree. And there were 2 months, I think it was two, at least one, where they were simply prevented from going. And it wasn't held against them. They couldn't do it. So it wasn't as though they did anything wrong. Nor would you be doing anything wrong if you couldn't get to Mass because of those obligations. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, it does. Yes.
Okay. Now, you can get some beautiful pictures of Jesus and Mary, the Immaculate Heart of Mary and the Sacred Heart of Jesus, if you go through a Catholic church goods store. Typically, they'll have them, in the store. Hopefully, they're open by now where you are, and you could go in and browse.
Yes,
and
I have a great one, and the name of it, as a matter of fact, is Two Hearts.
There you
my
go.
Local ones, but they are open.
That's a nice coincidence. And what I would recommend is, if your parish priest is free, invite him over for dinner. Have him bless your home and have him pray the prayers of enthronement of the Immaculate Heart of Mary and the Sacred Heart of Jesus in some prominent place in your home, a place of honor, and then you have done it. And, that's a very momentous and beautiful thing to do. And it puts everything and everyone on notice. that this is a house that's devoted to Jesus. And even the evil spirits will take notice and stay away.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Rayanne.
God bless
welcome
you,
home
all of
to
you.
The Catholic
too,
Church.
Cyrus. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
All right, I know.
Bye, thanks. See, Cyrus? It's a big old family, right?
They like me. They really like
they
me.
They really like you. Do you ever take the petals? Do you ever pull the petals off a daisy? They like me. They like me not. They like me.
It's been a good 35 years.
I think I did that when I was like in middle school or something. Yeah. I saw kids doing it. So when I realized by counting ahead that I was going to land on the like
yeah.
me
oh,
not,
yeah.
I would pull two petals out
yeah,
so can, that I could get to the
you can manipulate
like
the outcome of the
oh,
pulling
yeah.
of the petals.
Totally. Totally. John in Gaylord, Michigan, you're up. Welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. My wife and I have been separated going on for 2 years coming this August.
Okay.
And recently it's been a bit more tenuous. We Skype. I have children. Mm-hmm. Previously, her and I have one child together.
So there were each of you were married before this marriage?
I was not married before, and she was not married, but we have been married for 3 years, three and a half
okay.
years.
So the total number of children is one from this marriage, is that right?
I have seven children total.
Okay, so you fathered children, but you weren't married when you fathered them before this marriage with this woman?
Correct.
Okay. All right, please proceed.
Okay, so... recently, our relationship has become a bit more tenuous, and we try to Skype once a week with the entire family, and it's just became a bit more tenuous. And what my question is it a greater sin for me to remain separated or pursue an annulment at this point, because I do not believe that reconciliation is possible.
Okay. Were the two of you, are the two of you baptized, and are you both Catholic?
I am Catholic. I am baptized. My wife is not.
Not Catholic and not baptized?
Correct, in both okay. cases.
Okay. Well, so you don't have a sacramental marriage, because it takes both parties to be baptized in order for there to be a sacramental marriage. The church would need to determine through the process of this inquiry that we call, you know, the annulment process, whether or not the marriage is valid. And that can be done. The church can make that determination. I can't really answer the question as you put it to me, because I have no way of knowing whether or not she might be amenable to becoming Catholic and being baptized, in which case your marriage would become sacramental. You have seven children that you both, in some way or another, have been parenting. Are the children young? I mean, you say you have one together and that child's at home, I guess. Are the other children grown up?
That child is three. I have from 14 to four.
Okay.
Outside of that.
Okay, so are those children in your orbit? I mean, are they living with you?
Yes, they are.
Okay, this is going to require a few more questions before I can offer any thoughts. John, do you mind holding for a minute when I'll come back to you?
Please.
Okay, I'll be right back with John's question. We're going to look at this issue. Seven children, and he and his wife are separated, and where do we go from here? We'll look at that on the other side of this quick timeout right after this. No.